Today, I'm talking with Alexander Baldassare, who is the author of The Man Who Saw Seconds, which was just an extremely thought-provoking, time-bending book that I read recently that I really, really enjoyed. And it is about Preble Jefferson, who can see 5 seconds into the future. Otherwise, he lives an ordinary life. But when a confrontation with a cop on a New York City subway goes tragically wrong, those seconds give Preble the chance to dodge a bullet, causing another man to die in his place. Government agencies become aware of Preble's gift, a manhunt ensues, and their ambitions shift from law enforcement to military R&D. Preble will do whatever it takes to protect his family, but as events spiral out of control, he must weigh the cost of his gift against the loss of his humanity. A breathless thriller that will keep you on the edge of your seat until the very last page, The Man Who Saw Seconds explores the nature of time, the brain as a prediction machine, and the tension between the individual and the systems that we create. You really don't want to know much more than that, but it really does dive into how we kind of bend morality to match our motivations and what the cost of doing that looks like, as well as examining how government systems work and some of their vulnerabilities. So let's get into it. When I was reading your author bio, I think it was maybe one of the most unique bios that I've ever read. And obviously, you know all of this, but for the listeners, you have been an art gallery director in Bali, an attorney in San Francisco and Prague, a pseudo geisha in Japan, a hermit in Tennessee, a paleontologist in the Sahara, a porter in the high Arctic, a consultant on Wall Street, an art critic out of Jakarta and Singapore, and a police abuse watchdog and Times Square billboard writer in New York City. So amidst all of those things, when did you know that you wanted to write a book, and how did all of those experiences kind of shape what you write?
Well, I was an attorney for 11 months. I'm a member of the California Bar, but I realized very early on that it wasn't for me. So I've been in recovery ever since. And it was actually even before that, even in law school, I started writing for a school paper. I became the chief editorial columnist, and it was a law school paper, but I was writing things in haiku and Dr. Seuss poetry and just playing with experimental writing. So every column I'd play with a different style and different, just playing with words. And I was just, that suited my personality so much better than actual law. So when I became a lawyer, I already had the intention of, doing it just to save up a nest egg. My plan was 3 years, save up enough that I could, switch careers. And after 11 months, I was married to an artist at the time and hanging out with artists from the San Francisco Art Institute. It was just so jarring. My day job, 15 hours a day, working for a white shoe law firm that was doing international corporate law. And then coming home and these parties with artists. And it was like, I can't keep doing this. So I left the firm, and we moved to Bali, where I ended up running an art gallery just to help pay the bills. It was a big Italian owned art gallery, sent very, very successful. It sent artists to Venice Biennale, to the Miami Basel. And then through that, I became an art critic, because all the Italians are terrible. Their artist statements were it was usually Italian artists in an Indonesian art gallery. Nobody spoke English properly. I got to a point where I was rewriting everybody's artist statements. And then I got asked by an art magazine that was forming out of Singapore and Jakarta. They had two locations. They were starting a Pan-Asian art magazine in English. And so they asked me to become a contributor. And I started writing a monthly column. This kind of cultural criticism. And so I've kind of drifted all over. I've worked as a journalist for the Globe and Mail and other newspapers and magazines, just trying to pay the bills without being a lawyer. But the thing I always wanted to write was fiction. It's just, it's hard to make a living off of fiction. So writing has kind of tied in most of those jobs, with a few exceptions. Like in Japan, that wasn't to do with writing. But even the paleontology, I went to the High Arctic. I had an article on spec for National Geographic. But then, you know, there's a small team, so I had to basically help as a team member. And I wasn't a paleontologist, but I was big and strong. I could lift and carry things. I was on an expedition to the Sahara. That was also with the Discovery Channel. And so it was all kind of tied into writing. In New York, Civilian Complaint Review Board, I was a speech writer for the Civilian Complaint Review Board. So I wasn't actually an investigator of bad cops. I just speeches to city council. Mm-hmm. So that's one of the beauties of writing. It can take you all over the place.
Yeah. Yeah. That is really cool. So when you started writing fiction, you have a book you wrote before the Man Who Saw Seconds. What is your writing process like? Do you plot it out? Do you just kind of start writing and then follow where you're going, or how do you approach it?
I actually changed between The Ugly, my previous book, and this one. I changed both genres, because that was literary fiction. This is science fiction with some literary elements, I guess. Mm-hmm. But I also changed my writing process. So for The Ugly, it really was kind of just letting the book take me where it wanted to go, and then spending 16 years trying to bring it back under control. And I thought, okay, that's not a viable process. Yeah. So for The Man Who Saw Seconds, it was more structured. I mean, I knew the first scene actually came to me in a dream, weirdly enough. And I was able to lucid dream for many years. So I would every time I went to sleep, I'd put myself in a state where I would try to start the dream where I left off from the previous night. And it kind of worked. Basically, the subway scene, the very first opening scene of the book, came to me in a dream. Of course, I fleshed it out and I made sure it didn't feel like a dream, because there's no saying add a dream, lose a reader.
Yeah.
And then I knew the general themes I wanted the book to convey, and I kind of knew that I wanted to keep escalating. I didn't want to let the main character or the antagonist, I didn't want to let anybody off the hook. So I wanted to just keep escalating and escalating. Mm-hmm. And so I had kind of an architecture. I wasn't 100% sure at the very, very end how it was going to go, but I knew that I wanted to just keep escalating and see where that would take it. But the structure was much more, I had much more of an armature before I started with this one.
Yeah.
Because it's a much easier process on the author to know where you're going. Mm-hmm. And I think it ends up creating a more coherent book.
Yeah. It definitely is a book that could be described as constantly escalating. So you definitely feel that the whole time that you're reading it. So you kind of knew like the themes you wanted to get into and kind of where you wanted to start. How did you get to know Preble is the main character for the most part, but how did you get to know your characters that would kind of fit the plot?
I knew that the book, it was kind of one of the themes was this idea of one man against all the security organs of the state and all the government agencies. And so that's in part his slim superpowers, just enough to kind of even the odds between, you know, him and the country as a whole. And I knew that I didn't want to be political as the voice of the book, but I wanted to have some, you know, some ideas bouncing off each other. And so characters like Fish, I think if he had been the main character, it wouldn't have worked. But having him as a sidekick with his kind of, you know, the anarchist law professor, I could bring in some of the things I disliked about the law when I was a lawyer, give it to Fish. I felt like giving something like that to the main character would be too heavy-handed, whereas giving those ideas to a sidekick lets the author lets the reader make their own judgments of how they feel more easily. Like I'm a big believer in openness within art. Since we started talking about, you know, the art gallery, one of the things that made Rembrandt so, especially his later work, so compelling to viewers was his loose brushstrokes, which I kind of allowed the viewer in. Within visual art, it's true within visual art, it's true within writing. I think the artist or the writer needs to leave room for the readers to enter. And so I'm not, that kind of openness to me is very, very important, both in visual art and in writing. And so I didn't want to give any kind of conclusions. I don't want to tell the reader how to think, but I do want to frame the questions in interesting ways so that the reader can decide, I mean, at what point is Preble taking it too far? And it's been really interesting to see how different readers reach that point at completely different stages. I did another interview recently where the person told me that they were with him the whole time. And so it's it is really, really interesting to me to see that difference. And I don't want to set that difference. I don't want to reveal where I think that point is, because as an author, it would have too much weight. And so I think that's half the fun, is that's one of how you create kind of a dialogue with your reader, even though obviously I can't really talk to them usually. That to me is more interesting than telling people what I think.
Yeah, it's definitely what made the book so interesting to read, because Preble is the main character, but you do have chapters or scenes with, when you're kind of in the perspective of people from the side of the law. And the whole time, I mean, I was definitely with him. I understood both sides, I think, is what made it complicated and kind of uncomfortable sometimes, because when you're with one character, you understand their motivations. And then if you're with another one, you understand their motivations as well. So it does make it very conflicting, but it forces you to think about a lot of the issues for sure. And I read in your acknowledgments that like some of the inspiration from this book came from a time when your son was actually abducted. And so can you talk about how like that helpless feeling kind of transformed into this book?
Yeah. Well, I mean, as I mentioned, the acknowledgement, that's one of the amazing, one of the wonderful things about being a writer, is that you can take the most horrible experiences in your life and turn them into something positive. Or at least interesting. He was only abducted for 5 days, but it was like I had two really horrible times in my life. One was when that happened. One was when my wife died of cancer. And so a lot of that energy that is behind Preble, even though obviously the scenes are not from my real life, I don't have superpowers. I've never fought the cops. the emotional energy definitely came from that hopeless feeling of trying to protect your family. And in the case of my son, everything turned out very well. There was no long-term harm. You know, it was, everything worked out, even though I actually had the enamel on 14 teeth melted during that time. I went to a dentist and the dentist told me that you can clench your jaw to such an extent that it changes the chemical composition of the enamel. And, my teeth melted from stress.
God!
I didn't know that could happen until it happened to me.
Yeah.
And so there was definitely that emotional drive to try to, you know, get your son back, protect your family, and get your son back. That came from a real emotional experience. But again, the actual, I didn't mind the book for experiences, but I did mind it for emotional kind of fuel. I kind of like to think of the emotional themes and the intellectual themes as kind of the two wings that can help a story kind of get beyond just a very superficial, simple story. And I also wrote the book that if somebody wants to enjoy it just as a thriller, it's totally there just as a thriller. They can enjoy it like a Hollywood movie. I wanted to work on that level, but I also believe that a book can kind of go further if it's got both an emotional and intellectual component. So the emotional stuff definitely came from that experience with my son, and partially with my wife dying of cancer, but less so because I was only at the revision stage at that point. And then the intellectual stuff came from just kind of wanting to bounce different ideas against each other, you know, both having been born in a communist country where the state controlled everything, like down to every detail of your life, and kind of investing in, you know, what does freedom mean, you know, because people throw the word around so easily on all sides of the political spectrum, but it like, to me, in the end, freedom's openness. And even Preble himself, you know, I have this idea that kind of came in through Fish, but I do believe that institutions, as they get bigger, end up working against the purpose for which they were created. And if you hyper-focus on any one agenda, even something as important as protecting your family, that hyper-focus on thing, it can become counterproductive to the very thing you're trying to achieve. And that's why I mean, if there's one overarching message in terms of my own mindset of what freedom means, and it's openness. And you can see that with, you know, Big Man kind of getting obsessed with catching Preble and pulling out all the stops, like the whole society kind of goes crazy. Preble's single-mindedness, like everything becomes counterproductive because it's taken too far.
Yes. Yeah, that's, like, as I was reading it, it was making me really think about, like, even from the perspective of Preble trying to protect his family, you almost start to wonder if, like, really big consuming love ends up being dangerous as well, because he's so willing to justify any of his actions in the name of that, basically. So is that something you were even kind of trying to explore as well?
Yeah, you know, the old saying from Nietzsche, that if you stare in the abyss long enough, the abyss stares back. Like, when you fight monsters, you become a monster. And I don't know, I do think that the world is becoming, everything is becoming so extreme somehow in the real world that I kind of want to play with that idea.
Yeah, totally. So you mentioned it really does explore government structures and kind of like their vulnerabilities as well. So the beginning of the book even kicks off with Preble just kind of like wanting to exercise his right to not have something be searched. And so there's a quote there where it says, "It went like this: since law is just veiled power, the fewer people who believe in the rule of the law, the more transparent the veil. And the more the law has to obey its own rules in order to maintain legitimacy, the more people who believe in the rule of the law, the less likely it is to actually exist." So that's like his motivation. But then when we're on the side of the law or the military, they're basically taught to just like follow orders without questioning anything, and kind of told that that's like what keeps the system working. But then there's kind of a downfall if they're getting like really corrupted orders as well. So do you think there's room for like human discretion on the side of the law that doesn't hinder like the citizens that it's trying to protect? Or is it just kind of a human problem at large?
Yeah, I definitely think that, I mean, there's a tension. Again, there are both sides of the argument there, because on the one hand, the more discretion cops have, for example, then, you know, if they're racist or they're biased or they have, you know, personal agendas, then the more discretion they have, the more they can abuse their power. But at the same time, the fear of that sometimes has taken us to a point where we lose the human element. And when the law, the more the law becomes like a machine, the more stupid it becomes, in a sense, the less it's able to, because the law as a structure has to think ahead of time what is right and wrong. And the human situations and encounters are they're complex. And no law can think ahead of time all the possible variations of what a real system, I mean, what a real situation could look like, the context basically. Mm-hmm. And so you see, like the US is particularly far on that machine side of the law, whereas you know, if you're in the Holland, for my son's studying in Holland right now, so I'm spending a lot of time in Amsterdam. The police there have a nice, very kind of common sense gray area. There's a lot of gray area, where they just kind of, you know, if they see a kid doing something stupid, they're not going to give him a criminal record for life. They'll just kind of scare them a little bit and try to set them on the right path. You know, they'll act almost like parents, or it's just much more reasonable standard. And I remember one of the things, because mm-hmm. I lived in the US for 10 years, and when I left, mm-hmm. the thing that I kind of, there's a lot I love about the US, but the thing that I liked about leaving the US was the fact that there were gray areas again. Like there's something human about gray areas. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the thing that always struck me when I came into the US, even here in Canada, you know, buses or trains will say, please share the seat with a pregnant woman. Or if you see a pregnant woman, please give up your seat. In the US, it'll say, give up your seat. Give up your seat to a pregnant woman. It's the law. Like instead of just, okay, let's just be human and decent and reasonable. Obviously, if I see somebody who needs the seat more than me, as a decent human being, I should give it up. Without having to bring in, you know, the power of the police into it. and to me, that was it's a really big marker where the US is different from the rest of the world. It's the US, everything's black and white. Mm-hmm. And in most of the rest of the world, there's a lot more tolerance for gray areas. And for gray areas, you need people with discretion. And that means you need mm-hmm. a more educated pool from which you draw your police officers. It means you need to pay better salaries to police officers. So you get, you know, in New York City, when the NYPD tried to require a university degree for their cops, they couldn't fill the ranks. So they had to undo that again. But they were also paying, I mean, I have no idea what the salary is now, but when I worked in New York, it was $23,500, and you had to live within the five boroughs. Like, who could afford to live in the city now? So, it's this self-perpetuating cycle where if you want to give discretion to people, you need to be able to weed out the bad apples, which means you have to have higher standards. You have to pay people more so more people want the job. Mm-hmm. I mean, these are complex solutions that complex issues. I don't have an answer to, I think it's worth asking the questions.
Yeah, totally. Kind of in that same realm, we talked about Big Man is kind of he is Preble's nemesis. So he is who he's going up against, but he's also, I'm assuming you also weren't necessarily writing him as a villain either, because from his perspective, like, he is trying to protect humanity as a whole. So were you trying to keep him kind of, he's even in a little bit of a gray area too?
Yeah, I guess he'd be the least gray, but still he's a gray area because his job is to protect the country and later he thinks he's protecting humanity. But he's also, his methods are definitely wrong if to the extent there's a right and wrong. But one thing I was really wanted to be careful of with Big Man is I've always disliked books that where the good guy wins because the bad guy does something stupid. You know, like the stereotypical James Bond villain who talks so long that James Bond finds an escape because the villain talked too long. And that's always irritated me. Yeah. So I wanted to make a villain that was as compelling and as intelligent as possible so that it created a sense of dread for the main character because you know Big Man's not going to screw up. By the end of the book, you understand why he's taking some of the decisions he's taking. I didn't want to make it easy on Preble at any point by letting Big Man be a weak villain or a dumb villain or making mistakes. Again, because whether it's an argument or a book, I like steel, you know, the difference between a straw man and a steel man argument. I want to do it in the sense of characters, mm-hmm. too. I didn't want to give, you know, an easy out to anyone. And so,
yeah.
Big Man, I think the thing that makes Big Man interesting is that he is so intelligent. And mm-hmm. but he's also, you know, quite evil in his methods. But I think that, again, with
yeah,
that reflects to some extent, you know, I think there is a political dimension. There are people in power who do really think they know better than everybody else. And mm-hmm. And that they're, I don't think anybody sees themselves as a bad guy in their own eyes. Right. I mean, you can go all the way to Hitler, and I don't think Hitler ever saw himself as a bad guy in his own eyes. And so I think it's important
right.
to make your villains people who at least have some sort of as sick as the morality. I mean, not to saying that Big Man is as sick as Hitler, but no matter how
mm-hmm.
how wrong or twisted somebody's morality might be, within their own head, mm-hmm. it's going to have a rational structure and explanation.
Yeah.
And so I want to make sure that Big Man had that kind of internal moral structure and that had elements that even the reader could agree with. Like,
yeah. Yeah. Because he also was like so convinced that Preble really was a threat, an international threat, not just national. Just because he had different, well, I mean, it's like the ability to see a little bit of the future, but like, just because he had a little bit of an edge on everyone, he just assumed that meant that he was inherently dangerous, which is also like, you kind of understand it from his perspective, but you're also like, we all kind of have different, like strengths over other people too. So it's kind of like, is he really that dangerous? But he had totally decided that he
was. Well, I think part of that was because in that sense, Big Man was a personification of the system. And I think the system is kind of mindless in that if somebody's out, if it can't pull somebody into its own structure, like that was the idea that, you know, if just like ants, that's why I like the parallel of the ant colony, that mm-hmm. more is different. And so if a lot of ants go to a particular location, the other ants don't think about why they're going to that location. They just, there's a higher level of pheromones. That's why sometimes you end up, I don't know if you've ever seen it, these circles where ants get into this loop, and they will basically walk in those yeah. circles until they exhaust themselves, because the more ants walk in that circle, the more pheromones they drop, and then more ants come, and they just get stuck walking the circle until they all die of exhaustion. And I think to some extent yeah. our political system and our works in a similar way. And because Preble was, mm-hmm. it was impossible to bring Preble into the structures of the system. It just kind of kept adding more and more resources to try to pull him in, and they couldn't. So just, it created yeah. almost the version of those spiraling ants where it just spiraled out of control. And so Big Man was meant to be, you know, it's hard to draw, have a character that's the system. So Big Man, and that's why his name is Big Man. He yeah. was meant to be a personification of the system as a whole.
Yeah. Yeah. It totally felt that way. And you could just feel the way he was making decisions were so motivated by the system that he was in as well. And it did just keep escalating, as we mentioned earlier, since he had the power of all the systems like behind him, basically. So it still was an unfair fight for the most part, but he definitely was obsessed with getting to Preble. But yeah, I really loved it. I thought it was so much fun. It had me thinking about all kinds of things. I mentioned to you, if anyone has seen Civil War from A24, really similar feeling where you don't really know what good or bad is the whole time that you're reading it, well, watching in the case of the movie, but that makes it an even more exciting reading experience. So I really enjoyed it a lot.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate that. And I really appreciate what you were doing for books generally and me and my book specifically. Thank you.
Yeah. Yeah, totally. Where should people follow you to stay up to date with everything you're writing?
Well, my website is just my last name, boldazar.com. Okay. So that's easy. And then I'm on Twitter at boldazar. It's nice having a different last name I can get. URLs and the handles. On Instagram is at Alexander Boldazar. And the book is available pretty much everywhere, both in audiobook and ebook and paperback.
Nice.
Yeah, if possible, I always prefer people to buy it from a local bookshop, but I'll be happy with, you know, I'm happy with anybody reading it, even if you download it for free.
Right.
But yeah, if possible, support your local bookshop.
Yeah, totally. Well, I will put those links in the show notes for everyone. And thanks so much for coming on and talking about it.
Thank you again.